Let's return to This Week in America. Here's your host, Rick Bratton.
Welcome back, everybody, coast to coast, This Week in America. Great to have you listening to the program today. Does the hot hand really exist in sports? When will Chamberlain dominate in the NBA today? And why is Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak considered one of the most consecrated records in sports history? Well, scientist and researcher Sheldon Hirsch takes an unorthodox look at sports history in his latest book, Hot Hands, Draft Type, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths, an insightful and provocative collection of essays that question the so-called truths and conventional collective wisdom in sports, uses relevant data and objective analysts. Sheldon Hirsch grew up in New York City, an avid sports fan, wrestled at Amherst College as a board-certified pediatric kidney specialist, a self-professed sports geek and sports contrarian, co-author of The Beauty of Short Hops, How Chance and Circumstance Confound the Moneyball Approach to Baseball, now living in Chicago, but forever a Yankees fan, taking on the fallacies within the collective wisdom of the sports world in Hot Hands, Draft Type, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths, Sheldon Hirsch with us on This Week in America. Sheldon, welcome to the program. Looking forward to it.
Oh, thanks very much. I'm very happy to be here.
I really enjoyed the book. And let's do a little background here. You became a sports fan at age 7 in New York City. The early 60s, in fact, all of the 60s in New York, that was sort of the golden age of sports in New York City, wasn't it?
Yes, it was an incredible age to be introduced to sports. The Yankees were great. The football giants were great. Later on in the decade, the Knicks and Mets became great. But best of all, my dad was great. He was a great sports fan. He dated back to seeing Babe Ruth play in Yankee Stadium, and he made a point of teaching me love of the games. He taught me that basically a life worth living began every day at breakfast, reading the sports news and studying box scores. And I've been doing that for 55 years since. And that kind of wealth of sports experience that I could draw on was a big part of ending up in this book.
You know, I can remember growing up when you would get the sporting news once a week and go through all of the box scores for all of the games and how exciting that was. And we're really missing that today because it just doesn't happen that much anymore. But your dad was a calculus professor. Talk about that influence. I mean, he had a love of math. You got involved in Strat-O-Matic in games like that with your slide rule.
With a slide rule, which most people today don't know what it is nowadays with all the calculators and computers.
Yes.
But, yeah, he taught me how to calculate batting averages and earned run averages and slugging percentages with a slide rule. He taught me basic math. He taught me love of numbers. And, you know, sports is intrinsic, especially baseball, is intrinsically numerical. It's how we decide who wins the games, but it's also how we evaluate players, how we evaluate strategies. So a love of numbers really helps with a love of sports. Now, that said, numbers are just a small part of sports. A lot of what we love is the lore, the stories, the great athletes striving to achieve things that have never been done. Mickey Mantle versus Willie Mays in the 1962 World Series. Y.A. Tittle battered and beaten by the Chicago Bears in the 1964 NFL Championship game. Famous picture of him kneeling down, blood coming from his face. So, you know, love of sports is a mixture of things. And I think I try to bring all of that into this book.
Well, and the other part of that equation, your background in an analytical background, your mom was a debate coach. So once you get all of these numbers, you're able to present them in such a way, a very convincing way when you're discussing sports.
Well, I think to some extent, sports is not only intrinsically numerical, it's intrinsically argumentative.
Yes.
There's something about sports, and maybe sports fans are selected for this, that we love to argue about it. Who's better, Mantle or Mays? Who's better, Ruth or Ty Cobb? Would the 1996 Bulls beat last year's Golden State, or even this year's Golden State Warriors? Sometimes we do that over a beer in a bar. Sometimes we do that over a pack of Doritos in a living room. But we tend to love to argue about sports. And when you learn debate, which I did as a kid, You learn how to evaluate arguments, how to present arguments, how to keep an open mind, and that kind of lends itself towards sports. And then what happened to me a little bit later, which added on to that, is after, you know, loving sports for a while, I eventually had to grow up and get a job and make a living. And it turned out that I became a scientist and a physician, and that added another layer, because in science and medicine, you learn healthy skepticism. And a healthy skepticism says that even though someone may tell you something is true, they may claim to be an expert, they may have a veneer of expertise, that you should approach that with a healthy skeptical mind. Evaluate it for yourself, and if you don't see it the way they see it, speak up and say that. So applying that to the 55 years of sports experience that I had, not surprisingly, I found a whole bunch of, you know, convictions, conventional wisdoms, and dogmas that I didn't necessarily agree with. There were enough of them to fill 240 pages, and that's what this book is.
The book is called Hot Hands, Draft Type, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. With us on the program, the author Sheldon Hirsch. The book is available all across the country. Of course, you can log on to our website, thisweekinamerica.us, and go directly to information on the book. You talk in the book in the beginning about scientific and medical research papers. When you did those, they were routine because every argument had to be supported by evidence. And that's what's so interesting with your book. When you're making a statement, you're just not making a statement. You're actually backing it up with fact.
Well, sir, I appreciate that. That's certainly what I try to do. I don't pretend, it would be pretentious to say that I expect readers to always agree with me. That's not even the goal, but I take interesting events and athletes and things that have happened in sports, particularly controversial ones, and what I tried to do was present a solid argument so that even if the reader didn't necessarily agree, he would say, geez, that's something that makes sense, that's something that I haven't thought about before, and that, you know, reading about a good argument that makes you thinking about something that in a way that you hadn't thought about before, that should be interesting reading. And hopefully a succession of those turns the pages. Now, if the reader does agree with me on lots of things, all the better. But the goal really was a page turner of new ideas that would make readers think about important and sometimes famous, sometimes not famous, but interesting sports events in ways that perhaps they hadn't thought about before.
Yeah, just when you think, okay, I'm going to lay the book down for the night, I've got to get some sleep, or it's time to go off to a meeting, it's like, okay, but this next little essay, I really need to find out here if this is actually true. The mythology of Muhammad Ali, for example, stories like that in the book, Hot Hands, Draft Type, DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. Sheldon Hirsch, our guest on the program. Go back to 1963, the Dodgers and the Yankees. The game is piped in to your school room on the PA system, talking about how popular sports was, baseball in particular, during that time frame. One of the essays in the book is baseball's exaggerated demise. Talk about that, because we're almost led to believe that, boy, baseball's in its, they better do something real quick or they're going to lose an entire generation.
Yeah, that's a myth, I think, that occurs from time to time. And basically, what it does is ignore the history of the game, and in particular, the concept of regression to the mean. Now, baseball's demise was really talked about a lot 2 years ago when batting averages decreased to as low as a mean average of 251. And people had a variety of complaints about the game, too long, too slow, but those things could be fixed. But the thing that seemed most intrinsically problematic was too little action. Not enough runs, not enough scoring, not enough guys flying around the bases, batting average, runs scored, decreasing. But it turns out if you look back at the history of the game, there's a very interesting statistic, which is that the mean batting average of Major League Baseball for the last 85 years has very rarely strayed much from 260. It's ranged from 250 to 270. And every time it starts dipping down to 250 and people start worrying about it, it spontaneously increases. And every time it goes up towards 270, and people start thinking it's too easy to score runs, it spontaneously decreases. Now, to be fair, a single exception when they had to lower the mound in the late 1960s. But other than that, baseball seems to spontaneously correct itself. And that's exactly what's happened in the last 2 years. From that nadir of 251, the next year batting averages, home runs, and runs scored increased. Last year, same thing. Second year in a row, batting average, home runs, and runs scored increased. And it actually, this happened without anything extrinsic, no major rule changes or demographic fluxes or anything. It was just yet another example of the way baseball resists major changes and seems to keep itself going in a positive direction.
And you talk about patience being crucial in getting through this period. It's all in the book Hot Hands Draft Type. DiMaggio's streak debunking America's favorite sports myths. I've mentioned DiMaggio several times here. Let's talk about that. You go back and you look at this 56-game hitting streak, and you talk about consecutive versus consistency. Talk about that, because that's mentioned every year. Somebody will get a streak, 20, 30 games, and boy, nobody's ever going to touch what DiMaggio did, one of the great achievements in baseball. Talk about your perspective on that.
Well, certainly DiMaggio's hitting streak was a great piece of hitting. I don't mean to diminish that at all. By conventional measures, he hit .408 with 15 home runs over 56 games. But on the other hand, there have been several sequences of 56 games in which batters clearly did better than DiMaggio. For example, Rogers Hornsby, George Brett, and Ted Williams all had 56-game sequences in which they hit from .440 to .480, much higher than DiMaggio. And here's the best example of all. I think this is fascinating. Over the exact same time period that DiMaggio had his hitting streak, he wasn't even the best hitter in baseball. Ted Williams had a higher batting average and a much higher on-base plus slugging percentage. So the question I ask is, why do we give DiMaggio's hitting streak this iconic, almost religious reverence? Many people say it's the greatest feat in baseball history. Some people say it's the greatest thing ever done in any sport.
Yes.
When other 56-game sequences were clearly superior. And in a nutshell, there are multiple aspects of this that the book goes through, but I think the most important has to do with the word consecutive, as you said, because any elevation of DiMaggio's streak over the others has to be centered on its consecutiveness. His streak was consecutive, the other streaks were not. So I asked, what is it about consecutive? What is the meaning of consecutive? What is the benefit of something being consecutive? And how or does that actually apply to DiMaggio's streak? And I'll leave you with just this one thought, which is that the items of interest that hit in DiMaggio's streak actually were not consecutive. They were separated by many at-bats. They were unrelated to each other. And there's no sense of the whole of the hits being any greater than the sum of the parts. So the book goes into that kind of analysis, and I think if the reader approaches it with an open mind, which is very hard to do with DiMaggio's streak because it's a religious object and everybody is so certain about it, but if you go into an open mind, I think you will at a minimum come out looking at DiMaggio's streak differently than you did before.
See, that's the fun of the book. Before, it was 56-game hitting streak, end of story. Boy, this is one of the greatest feats ever. And now it brings it into, it puts it in a whole different perspective. The book is called Hot Hands, Draft Type, and DiMaggio's Streak, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. With us on the program, Sheldon Hirsch, the author. Why is it that these stories, these philosophies, persist for so many years? Is it a case of if we hear it enough, we start believing it?
Well, I think there are a lot of cognitive issues, if you will, about myths and beliefs. One of them, for example, is what's called anchoring, which is that the tendency for all of us as human beings, once we get an idea in our mind that we're convinced of, we act in a way to sustain that belief. And in fact, we sometimes ignore contrary evidence, or worse yet, we take contrary evidence that develops and twist it to support our case. So anchoring is an issue with maintaining what I'll call fixed ideas. Now, another issue, I think, is that as human beings, we like simple stories. We like simple stories more than complicated stories. And one of the simple kinds of stories that are particularly appealing are heroes and goats. Now, games are rarely won and lost because of one person. It's usually a more complicated thing with multiple, contributors positively and negatively. Yet that's a complicated story. It's difficult to tell. It's harder to understand. And frankly, it's just less appealing. We like the idea of the David beats Goliath.
Yes.
Or the just great Superman who triumphs over, tremendous opposing forces. And similarly, when our teams fall apart, for example, the 1986 Red Sox, we end up with another simple story, the GOAT. It was all Billy Buckner's fault, which, in fact, it clearly wasn't. So I think our want for simple stories sometimes explains how we think about things in this sort of monolithic way.
As we're ending the end of the NBA season, getting into playoffs, you do a good job about talking about the story that's out there, the philosophy. You can't win an NBA championship without a shot first, shooting first point guard or a superstar. And you go through that and the fallacy at the end of the game when we all want the star to take a shot. The defense knows it, and if the guy passes, suddenly he's not up to the hero status anymore.
Yeah, so I think those are good example of anchoring. So,
yes.
For example, the idea has come down throughout NBA history that you must have a so-called shoot-first point guard. And this came to the head in the last couple of years, especially with Russell Westbrook, who by no means is a pass-first point guard. And he's received a lot of criticism from the likes of Charles Barkley and some national NBA writers to the point where they have headlines that, you know, Oklahoma City can't win with Westbrook, blah, 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 things like that. Well, in order to hold to that statement, you have to ignore multiple NBA teams in history that have won with point guards who did not hew to that Jason Kidd, John Stockton model. In fact, in recent years, the Spurs won with Tony Parker. Cleveland won last year with Kyrie Irving. Detroit won not too long ago with Chauncey Billups. And there are any number of point guards who, maybe not quite so much as Westbrook, but certainly were not in the Stockton mode and wouldn't be said to, you know, be so-called pass-first point guards. I think, again, that's a simple story. I think it's also anchored. And it also follows a theme that sometimes we get these ideas that there's only one way to do something. There's only one strategy that wins an NBA championship. There's only one way for a Major League Baseball team to succeed. So here's an example of that. Moneyball took hold. And for some very good reasons, we developed this idea of strategies that are important to win in baseball. And then 2 years ago, Kansas City wins the World Series. And Kansas City wins the World Series without following Moneyball strategies. In fact, in many cases, the manager, Ned Yost, did the opposite of things recommended in Moneyball. So then he wins the World Series, and you know what some of the headlines read? Kansas City wins despite Ned Yost. Ned
yes.
Yost is
yes.
a moron, and yet Kansas City wins the World Series. And Ned Yost is a moron because he didn't follow some very narrow, you know, specific pathway to a championship. Now, I think in basketball, in all the major sports, there are multiple ways to win, and we shouldn't have these sort of fixed platonic ideas about a path that it must be followed, or else you're a moron, even if you win.
A couple minutes left in the program. You talk about the love of heroes causes us to ignore contrary evidence. You use, as an example, LeBron James. A couple of years ago, the 2015 NBA final had a poor shooting experience during the finals, and we were making excuses. Talk about how the love of heroes sort of comes in and blocks our judgment.
Well, for example, let's talk about LeBron. 2 years ago when he went into the finals against the Golden State Warriors and basically most of the time was without Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love, and he played fantastically. He carried them to a 2-1 lead. He led both teams in scoring, rebounds, and assists, and he was terrific. But he shot poorly. He shot 40% from the field, 30% or so from three-point line, and you'd think that the analysis would be something like LeBron James has played great, and his all-around game has been great, but boy, he's missing shots. But that's not what you heard. And the want to make LeBron James's postseason series against Golden State the greatest ever, all the announcers made excuses for him. He was tired, even though he missed shots early in the game. Better yet, this weird thing that he was holding the ball till the last second to slow the game down and then taking bad shots against the shot clock. Now, what kind of strategy would that be, to willingly take a bad shot at the end of the shot clock? That's not a strategy. That's not what he was doing. And if you look at the tape, he had all sorts of open three-point jumpers that he was missing. And, in fact, he was missing them throughout the whole playoffs. Even in the earlier rounds, LeBron James shot poorly. So he had a poor shooting postseason, and he really wasn't called out on that, because he was so heroic in other aspects that the want to call him a hero and maybe even bask in his reflected glory seemed to blind everybody to the weakness of his shooting.
Just one of the many great stories in the book, Hot Hands, Draft Type, and DiMaggio Strict, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. Sheldon Hirsch is our guest in the program, the author of the book. Book taking on all the hot-button issues of the sports world today, all of the controversies, all of the great debates. The book is available all across the country. Of course, you can log on to our website, thisweekinamerica.us, and link on directly to information on the book. Sheldon, it is an excellent read, a most enjoyable book. Thank you so much for being with us on the program today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I enjoyed speaking to you very much.
Once again, the book, Hot Hands, Draft Type, DiMaggio Strike, Debunking America's Favorite Sports Myths. Sheldon Hirsch, our guest and on the program and author. Books available all around the country. More information at our website, thisweekinamerica.us.
You're listening to This Week in America with Rick Bratton. More after this.